Hello, everyone. Welcome to the fifth podcast. We have our fourth guest today. John McNair is back after a brief hiatus.
Hello, I'm back.
He's back.
I know you all missed me so much.
And we have a guest I'm very excited about today, one of my long-time good buddies, Luke Murray. So, Luke, thanks for coming on, and if you'd like to introduce yourself to everyone, that'd be great.
Yeah, so I'm Luke Murray. I go to Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Iowa. I'm majoring in history and minoring in philosophy, maybe changing that to a major soon. While I'm at Cornell, I run cross country and long distance in track, and I volunteer on the fire department in Mount Vernon.
Mm-hmm. So Luke, wait, I actually don't know what the formal answer to this would be. How long do you think you and I have known each other?
I count from LIT.
Yeah.
We ran against each other in high school, but I didn't,
right. So
we
like
didn't know each other from that. So.
Probably for 5-6 years getting up there. And then really each summer spending,
staff, so
I mean, living pretty
year.
Much living together for you know, 3-4 weeks at a time each summer.
In one
too.
Way or another, living together. Yeah, so about 6 years.
Yeah.
Did y'all do running camp together?
We did the same running camp, but not at the same time.
I think it was consecutive weeks, but I'm not sure.
I think so.
It was too many years ago now to be able to figure that out.
Exactly. So, do you want to tell everyone kind of your history at camp, how long you've been going, and also kind of with your sisters and all that type of stuff?
Yeah, so with camp, for a long time, me and my brother were kind of like, I'm in a family of two boys and two girls, and after a Girl Scout retreat that one of my sisters went on, they were just dying to go to High Harbor. Eventually convinced my parents, and then that led the other sister going. After the first sister had gone and like told her about it, so for a while there my brother and I were just like anti-camp because it was like the guys versus girls thing, just like what happens in a family, because I was closer to him and we shared a room, they were closer to each other and they shared a room, but eventually he was like all about sports and like just naturally good at every sport he tried, and I never really found a sport I was that great at until late middle school or high school, so I just didn't really have as much going on in the summers, so I eventually decided to try camp. That was 11 years ago now, and I've been coming to camp at least 1 or 3 weeks ever since. Last 6 years I've been on staff, and it's been a crazy time that I just can't imagine not having around. At this point, Blake and I were talking about it earlier, and I think at this point, most of our memories at camp, because we've been on staff for so long, have been memories of being on staff rather than, campers. I think that's kind of the weird thing. For so long, like, we know being campers influenced us, but I don't remember much of anything specific from before the leadership program, which were the last 1 or 2 years of
it had
camper.
To have appealed to you as a camper, right?
And it's interesting because
with it for this long.
When exactly. It's interesting because since I've been on leadership and like LIT staff for 2 years, one of the most common things that the staff will say to the LITs is like, you know, think of that staff member that you had that like changed your summer when you were a camper, and like think of that, and the motivation, or at least the message, is oftentimes to pull from your memories as a camper. And now that I feel like that a lot of our memories are as staff, and then as you keep going, say when you're a CIT or an AC, it stops being think of the memories of when you were a camper, and now it's think of the memories from last year, the year before, the older staff members, the head counselors, the program directors that like really motivated you and pushed you. Do you feel like that's been the same for you?
Definitely. I think what's really interesting about that is that there have been staff members that influenced me pretty strongly as a camper, and for that reason I remember them for a really long time and would think of them as LITs, as an LIT or a really junior staff member. But since they were still there when I was a staff member, I started looking up to them for very different reasons, having a different perspective on what they did, and just coincidentally it was the same person, or maybe not so coincidentally.
Right. Exactly.
So I think that's one of the things that's really interesting from using that prompt of if you have the perspective of them being your leader, if they're a good leader, it almost doesn't matter what form of follower you take. They're always going to stand out to you if they're really that great of a leader, and they're always going to be someone you want to look up to and emulate in whatever capacity you see them.
One thing that I've found really cool about this year in particular is being program directors with or like alongside some of the people that were, you know, your counselors when you were an LIT or your counselors when you were a staff member, that are not even 1 year removed, but 2 or maybe 3 years even removed, which has been really cool.
Yeah, there aren't a lot of those left. Usually after 2 or 3 years, a PD moves on, but every once in a while, and sometimes when they become pro staff who work year round, mm-hmm. you'll see them again, and you remember them being in your cabin. I mean, I was a head counselor at the same time as my cabin five counselor. The first year that I came to camp was still at camp, Colin Scanlon.
Yeah. Do you want to also, because you were just talking about Petey's becoming pro staff, do you want to tell John about your sister's involvement at camp?
Oh, yeah. So, of course, my sisters went to camp before me, but they also became staff. And so my oldest sister, Emma, was staff for years and years, was a PD for a really long time. So committed to camp that she went to school at UCLA, and since they're on a quarter system, they finished school considerably later than we do here. So she would fly home on a red eye and do a 24-hour turnaround from being on West Coast time to coming to camp and being on an LIT schedule because she was leadership PD that year.
She was on a LIT schedule too?
That's correct.
She was like pretty much what I did the last two summers, but the program director for it. And for the entire summer for 9 weeks straight.
And she had like zero time to adjust from a West Coast schedule. So she'd be getting up at like 6 a.m.
If I've ever heard of it.
So then she eventually became pro staff at Lake Burton for a couple of years. She now lives in Chicago, but she was pro staff at Burton for a couple of years. So that was kind of something weird that like, had she not moved to Burton to be pro staff, because that's just where the opening was, I could have been like an AC or a head counselor under her as pro staff. Mm-hmm. And then my other sister, Janie, that was Emma. My other sister, Janie, she was a PD for a couple of years. She never ended up becoming pro staff, but I have like friends who are LITs and ACs and heads with me that like were in her cabin and saw her as one of those forming figures in their camp careers. So it's kind of weird to feel like I have that to live up to, but also know that everyone sees individuals so separately at camp that I don't actually have to, that I can just like be my own person. And what shines through for both of us because families form that way.
What do you think you guys have gotten like personally the most out of camp? Like, I feel like it's been very developmental for you, Blake. I don't know.
So
it's
yes,
been the same for you.
I think anyone who's gone to camp this long and has been in staff for as long as we have.
I mean, obviously, it's.
But I want to hear your perspective, like, because you have been part of the program that forms staff in a way that I haven't.
Right.
I only got a few weeks in that program, and you've had multiple summers.
So, it's actually interesting because, last night I was on the phone, I guess you could say networking or learning or whatever, with that lady who's a lawyer, the entertainment law lady. And it was interesting because she had asked me, you know, what you're up to. And I said, oh, you know, I'm at camp, blah, blah, blah. And then we started talking about servant leadership because she knew about the TED Talk and stuff like that. And she just said, like, if you had to define it, what is servant leadership? And it's hard because I feel like I think about it so often, yet I can't, like, define it. It's kind of like what we were talking about earlier. It's one of those things where it's like, you don't know how to define it, but you know it when you see it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I'd say just generally, like, the, I don't even want to call it, like, a life mantra, but maybe, like, the call to action or, like, I guess life philosophy, you could say, or just like lifestyle, your day-to-day of servant leadership has been the biggest for me because, you know, as a camper, I went 1 week, probably four summers, I think. And then after water sports, when we went, I was done for 2 or 3 years. And then it took breaking my back and not being able to play summer baseball anymore to go back as an LIT. And when I went in as an LIT, I remember you have to do, you know, all these retreats and stuff, and I just knew nobody, and it seemed like camp. It probably does seem like this to outsiders, that it's just such a big family and everyone knows everyone and like it's almost scary and exclusive and stuff. But I remember going in and just being really scared, and that's definitely not how it was. And then so I kind of, I guess, recreated my career and life at camp, starting with the LIT program. And so that's kind of why it sticks with me the most, as opposed to, you know, certain memories of like really fun or maybe even creative parts of camp. Because I think that now a lot of the staff who do really well and get a lot of deserved recognition are very creative in the skills that they come up with or in the checkoffs that they have or just little things that they do with the kids that the kids react well to. But so since I think a lot of the people who were campers and then staff think about the creative side, I've definitely been one of the few, I think, that don't necessarily think about all those crazy fun parts of it. It's been more of almost like the ALA, the Advanced Leadership Academy, it feels like it's almost been a leadership academy for me throughout because, you know, did LIT, then as a CIT, was in cabin five, which is, you know, the youngest guy's cabin, which was, I'd definitely say a growing experience, is if nothing else, in patience. You know, Luke and I were actually in cabin five together. He was the assistant counselor.
I was in cabin five a couple of years.
Yeah. And we were staff together because he was the assistant counselor when I was a CIT, which is cool. But, if nothing else, it was a, you know, growing experience in patience, and then being on, leadership staff the last 2 years. It's one of those things where it's like if you're studying for a test, and then you have to tutor someone, or you have to teach it to them, you're going to learn it more in depth, and you're going to understand it more fully yourself. I think it's been almost one of those things where it's like, by having to teach the ideas of servant leadership and, I guess just what a fulfilling life through service and uplifting others is, you learn so much more about it. And it was one of those things where it's like, because you're living it out and you don't even get an off minute or anything to like take a break and think about something else. Cause when you're at camp, it consumes you. Because you don't even get a chance to think about it, it's just you're perpetually thinking about the idea of servant leadership and kind of that philosophy that I pretty much, I had so many ideas at so many times that I, you know, I've never really done this before, but I felt so inclined to journal just every day. And sometimes, like, when I'm at school or if whatever is happening and I'm stressed, I'll go back and look at those, like, journal entries I had from the 2 years that I was on LIT staff and just remember, like, how, you know, meaningful and fulfilling life can be when you're doing it right. And I think that kind of getting on to wrap it up here, to getting on to some like Jordan Peterson ideas, I definitely think that one of the reasons that I've realized this year about camp is that I think that why it is so fulfilling is it perfectly toes the yin and yang line of order versus chaos. Because I think that there is a lot of order and like tradition, and, you know, almost culty things that we do at camp, and there's, you know, there's structure to it, but it's at any moment, at any time, there's so much chaos that could ensue. Each day changes so much, and I think that like almost entering the chaos and like bringing it into order through service is what has been most fulfilling to me.
Definitely. I think one of the things that I noticed was both of us have had to apply servant leadership in our daily lives so much. I've thought about a little bit about how to define it, and I've found no better way to describe it than what I've heard Simon Sinek say in discussion of his book Leaders Eat Last, where he talked about how the idea is that, well, you put your followers first, you put their care above your own, because that shows them that you care more about keeping them in the group and keeping them as a group safe than you do about keeping yourself safe. And that leads to them wanting to reciprocate that to you. And I think that's a lot of how we're able to so consistently draw high quality staff from our campers, is we show them we will put them above ourselves, and that motivates them to want to do the same for camp, give back. I don't think it's consistent. I think it's really hard to compete with the broader world. But I think when you're there, it's such its own universe that you're constantly occupied, that you're in this other mindset that's so hard to replicate anywhere else that I've experienced.
So would you say that servant leadership has been the biggest thing that you've taken from camp? It's so hard to answer that question, I know, but would you say if one thing?
Yeah, I think that and how to spot and develop in-depth friendships. So I think camp is somewhere that everyone is very themselves, because even if you know that you work there and you're going to be there for a bunch of weeks, the people there are changing so constantly that there's no point in any kind of pretense, because you just assume, even if most of the people here are still going to be here next week, enough of them are going to change that me doing this now has very few long-term consequences in terms of people knowing your deeper self. So knowing that has made me more able to spot the deeper friendships that I can find, as opposed to good friendships that are kind of surface level. I know that's kind of hard to define, but I think everyone has that really deep friendship that like somehow they know just click very quickly. And being able to spot
that.
It's
the same every time
you
come back the next summer, regardless of the changes that have happened in each other's lives.
Like, I've found that outside of camp, but for some reason it's a lot easier to recognize that in camp because of that, like, release of pretense.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the image that you put yourself as out there.
John, I'm interested to hear, just from your experience, and I know it's been a while, so, you know, you can be completely honest, but your memory as, like, what you thought of, like, what camp meant to you when you were a camper, if it was just a place for fun, and then also, like, what you thought of the counselors and if you even knew this entire side of, you know, how fulfilling and like how much of almost, like we said, a cult or religion in a sense it was for some of the people there.
Damn. Well, I'd say when I was there, honestly, it was more of just a place to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I was involved in summer baseball. And so that was kind of like a week off from summer baseball for me.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I didn't also get so much of the, like, culty side. Like, I didn't pick up on that,
mm-hmm.
I don't think. I think a lot of it for me was just, it seemed like a bunch of teenagers having a good time. Like,
right.
They're enjoying it too, you know, which isn't, like, necessarily a bad thing.
I mean, fun follows fun.
No, yeah, right.
Saying?
Yeah. If we weren't having fun, you wouldn't.
Yeah. No, they definitely were trying their best to, like, get everyone to, like, loosen up. I remember,
like, during morning assembly,
during
singing
morning
songs.
During morning assembly, like, if you weren't singing, I remember, like, people would, like,
get
come
in your
up
face,
to you and,
yeah.
like, be like, sing, man, sing, like, get crazy. And I'm like,
yeah.
Dude, I'm, like,
I mean,
I'm, like,
that. I've kept five campers. They don't sing half the time, even
yeah.
if I do push them around.
Like, I went in, like, a very awkward, like, time when everyone was, like, well, what does everyone think about me?
Yeah.
What does everyone think about me? Like, you're like 12 years old or however
yeah.
old you are.
That's just how
and it's
is
like the LITs were like not that much older than you, you know?
Yeah. At the time, you usually don't realize it. But they're only like 2 years older
yeah.
than you at most.
I definitely realized it.
I'd like to think they don't realize it.
You know who was
yeah.
our LIT? Right. Jake Piggott, when we were both in all sports. Yeah. He was my head counselor when I was in LIT. But
Jake Piggott.
Yeah.
Was he kind of chunkier?
No, he looked just like you. Everyone said that they used to get y'all confused.
Oh, that's hype. That's hype. As a 12-year-old, I was getting confused with a 14-year-old. Let's go. But yeah, that was my memories from camp. I went to Burton when I was like 6 or 7, and I don't really remember anything from that besides pissing my bed.
You were one of those.
Yeah, I was one of those kids.
I remember
my mom sent me this huge care package and everyone was like stealing my snacks and stuff.
Sounds about right.
And I was like, guys, you were not my friends anymore. Chill.
But that's, I mean, honestly, just saying like that was a place that you went to like have fun. I mean, that's
yeah.
literally the reason like yeah. that's completely satisfactory answer for us.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, maybe it didn't have the same like impact that it had on y'all
mm-hmm.
as for me,
but it was
but,
still
like,
done well.
It was still a good time.
It's also, I don't know if we want to get too into this, Luke, but when you were talking about the Leaders Eat Last thing,
mm-hmm.
John, the other day when Luke and I were doing work crew, we were talking about how, and he alluded to earlier, how they're like systemic, maybe sexist, like practices that go on at camp and stuff
and
like
I
that.
And I think it's like the kind of thing that you don't even realize you're doing sometimes. Like, you're looking for someone to like cut down the tree, like cut up a tree that fell or something, or like just clear the road, and like it's not on purpose, but you think of one of the guys' staff to do it rather than one of the girls' staff to
yeah.
like go
well,
grab the chainsaw for maintenance.
And also,
like,
I think
it's
a better
purpose,
example is when we like Luke and I were two. It was just us two, and on Monday we did work crew like throughout the whole day. Like, we had a bunch of stuff we had to do, and then the following day there was a group of three girls and our one of the pro staff who like runs all of the work crew stuff and tells us what maintenance to do. He told them like they're done after lunch, and he was like, y'all can just go lifeguard. And then we ended up filling in for work crew again today. Like, stuff like that where
yeah.
it's just, you know, maybe these implicit biases or whatever.
No, I don't think it's quite as like blatant, because there are context things to that. I mean, like that the day that we had been doing maintenance crew together on Monday, we were asked to go fill in, and it was the following day. I mean, we knew that we needed a few extra lifeguards. But that he didn't even think about plan. Like, we didn't need three extra lifeguards. We needed at most two.
Mm-hmm.
But that he didn't even plan to have them do additional work crew. I mean, we'll always take more lifeguards. We can always use it. It's a lakefront. It's not a pool. It's an uncontrolled setting. It wasn't like they were doing nothing there. But it is little things like that that I've heard girl side complain about and, like, mention as, like, we think he has an implicit bias.
And I also...
And it's so hard to be aware of those things.
So the girls do complain about it? They're not,
yeah.
like, saying, oh, I mean, I don't mind.
No, the girls are complaining about it.
It's specific and, things they talk about, and it's not
it
as blatant as just,
guys,
like...
I also think it's...
It like
so I think there's also a very... Luke and I talked about this during camp.
Yeah.
I posed the question, do you think that, do you think that camp promotes tribalism? And if so, do you think that's bad? And my motivation for asking that question was, there are certain things like cabins versus cabins with winning the tuna, but then also, and I think this is more toxic, is like guy side versus girl side. It's always this constant like power struggle. Guys think, I think the guy side kind of has this hero complex as to, we're the ones that run camp and we're the only ones that are capable of like keeping camp afloat. Yeah.
And I don't think it's not, and this is going to sound bad, but I think to an extent it's a little bit intentional not to create a like sexist tribalism aspect, but like
it seems pretty
when
trivial.
You say when you it does
it,
seem
it does when you're
trivial.
Out on the outside, but on the inside,
but on the inside it feels
lives.
Like
I mean, they're there for 9 weeks, either they live
yeah and I think what it does, if you're going to break down to what it actually is helpful for, that it doesn't hurt, and this is the only thing I can come up with that it actually helps with, is when you say stuff like, we keep camp running, they're just there to fill spots, it gives you this like motivation to feel like there's no second line of defense. I have to give it all or else it's going to fall apart. And I don't think that's honest. I don't think it's realistic, but it helps us motivate. And I feel like there are probably better ways to do that. But in the meantime, it's hard to break people's habits and traditions and implicit biases, even if they're entirely illogical.
Yeah. I think also when I mentioned the, Leaders Eat Last thing, John, that conversation was kind of straying, that Luke and I were having, was kind of straying from camp and getting more into the idea of just chivalry in general, because I asked Luke, you know, do you think it's bad that we allow the girls to eat first every time? Like, it goes, the kids eat first, like, if the girls eat first, and then
girl
the
campers, guy campers,
girl staff,
PDs, guy PDs,
and then
pro staff.
And so
I feel like it's not necessarily harmful unless the individual states otherwise. Like, a lot of people appreciate that sort of politeness, I think.
I agree. I also think I don't know where the wave of feminism that we're on now it wants to go with it, because I mean, if in a, and I know, I'm not saying like, oh, there's a double standard here, but I'm just saying, if we want things to be purely like equal, then it shouldn't matter regardless. I'm not saying, oh, as a guy, like, it sucks that I'm eating like after everyone. Like, I think everyone should just go at the same time. I'm just saying, I think it almost is like, could potentially be almost stripping, agency, or like, you know, because leaders eat last, that's the philosophy. And in, Luke knows, in historical eras, like, the leaders would always eat last. It's like the people that I'm caring for, the people that I'm in charge of, I have control over all these people, they're going to go, and then I'm going to go. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, you girls go.
Sort of patronizing attitude.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think it's an implicit thing. I don't think anyone really thinks about it. I don't think it's the intention. We even asked one of the girls' staff, and she, like, didn't even think of that. It was nothing.
Do you want to tell the historical story that you told me the other day?
Yeah, so the basic form that I was... which example was I talking about?
You're talking about some king in, like, ancient something.
I don't remember that.
Well, it was a cool story about just, like, where the Leaders Eat Last thing originally came from.
Yeah, so, I mean, it came from... I know what it was. It was Roman soldiers. So, like, if Roman soldiers had to evacuate a city of Roman citizens to get, like, because Gothic tribes were coming to raid the city or something, they wouldn't say, here, follow our entire legion out. They would say, we're here to push you out, and then we will defend at the city gates while you guys go to a safer city. And I think my thinking was, like, basically... that has always been a thing, that, like, if it's my job to protect you as a soldier to the citizens, then of course I'm going to stay behind and face the gruesomeness, and I'm going to put your safety before my own, because that's my job. So in a way, and it's entirely implicit, I think it's a deeper psychological thing, if it's at hand at this point, then couldn't this be taken as, we are the protectors, we run camp, we're the really important part of staff, therefore we care more about your well-being than our own, so of course you should eat first. And my concern is that I think it's hard to tell if that's the force at play, but if it is, we've gotten to the point that the main things that create a sexist, or I think this plays to racial issues as well, I mean, maybe less so, but in any situation where there's a discrimination that's become primarily, if not exclusively, an implicit issue, then you have to take a look at those symbolic things that seem like they don't mean anything, because that's where those kinds of implicit issues cemented themselves. So you have to start with those as well, start taking those away as well. And we mentioned to a girl side staff member, her initial go-to was, well, it's also just about managing the chaos. I mean, like, you have to have someone go first, and everyone has to know who goes first.
I was going to say, there's some, like, practicality for it. Like, some people just do some things, some people do other things, you know?
Absolutely. And I think there's a very good chance that's what's happening.
Yeah.
I hope that's what's happening, and I'm not just missing something and being blind to it. But if I'm wrong, there are other ways to ensure there's an order to the chaos. Say the younger kids go first, so 1 and 5, 2 and 6 go eat. That's the same size if you split guy side and girl side. And then you say 7, 8 water sports, 3, 4 go eat. Now ALCs go eat, staff. If you do it like that, or you did it by cabin, that's just as systematic and controls the chaos. And honestly, if staff could eat with their younger campers, it would make it a lot easier for us to make sure, as someone who's been in cabin 5 a lot, that your camper isn't getting just rolls, or like 12 chicken fingers and no vegetables, or like 3 pieces of cake, which is a thing that we have to deal with, as trivial as it sounds. Of course you were. So there are benefits to changing the system, and I don't know if anyone's even thought about it, or if it's actually worth it.
I do want to move on, because I think that you gave a good segue implicitly in what you were saying earlier when you were talking about some of the discriminatory actions that might be almost exclusively implicit now, especially with your relationship to police and to police officers, and how you kind of see them as a firefighter, as a resource, but also as like the almost personal relationships you have with them. So I just want to hear what you have to say as to kind of the culture that you see there.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people for a long time have had an understanding of like firefighters versus cops being just like a rivalry in any city. But it's one of those rivalries. I think of it a lot like guy side and girl side, where it's a constant power struggle until it actually matters. And then you're just one group of staff, or you're one group of first responders. So when I see stuff like a police officer gets killed or a police car gets destroyed, I appreciate the thinking behind that. I get where it comes. I agree. I think there's a systematic issue going on and we need to address it. But at the same time, I know people. Todd is one of my friends on the fire department. He's like a dad. We're not at all at the same age level. I wouldn't consider him a friend if it weren't for the fact that within the fire department, we're to some extent on like an equal playing field. But I also know when he's not volunteering with the fire department, he works as a cop in Mount Vernon. And he is a fantastic EMT. He was trained in medical stuff by the military. I know he knows what he's doing with all of his weapons. I know he's doing these jobs not because he sees them as glorious, but because he knows they're important to a society running. And my ability to not see some part of Todd in every individual cop I've met is extraordinarily limited. I know in any group there are going to be, people say bad apples, but I think that trivializes it, flawed people. I mean, people are inherently flawed. I think any view of humanity is going to include that. Any honest view of humanity, anyway. And if you're realistic with this, an individual, you have a hard time blaming any select individual for the systemic issues. So while I agree and have no issues with the larger defund the police idea of preventative measures being more important, because I think they absolutely are, I have a hard time looking at an Atlanta cop that I've never met and not assuming that this man knew it was a thankless civil servant job and he wanted to help a community. Even if he, and I'm assuming, of course it takes a lot of assumptions and a positive view of larger human nature, that person is someone that, were I responding as a firefighter, could and would save my life from any number of issues. And while I want the systematic things to change, it's hard for me to condone anything that affects the individuals so negatively if it's not a larger systematic change that just affects everyone.
Defund the police, to my understanding, is they're reallocating funds that the police use towards other things, right? Is that all it is?
That's my understanding of it as well.
So what does that include? Does that include policemen working less? Like, because I think that's how it's been framed for a lot of people who are against it.
Yeah, so my deeper I wish for a deeper understanding of what the political agenda behind it is. But my understanding at this point is that it's primarily police have disproportionately large budgets out of a municipal, like, budgetary pie of, like, the city has this much money, the police get this portion, and that's disproportionate. And the idea is the same idea as we need to cut the military's funding. We're not saying take their legs out from under them. Mm-hmm. We're not saying have sweeping layoffs, but recognize that there are other things that achieve the same ends through less controversial, less problematic, and generally more positive means. So my understanding of it would be that it, like, funds, rather than being dedicated towards police and new police cars, is you have cars that work even if they're not great, so we're going to put money into drug rehabilitation in our area so that...
Education.
So that you will react to whatever crime happens. I think there's a portion of police that are just inherently reactionary. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that we need to take a bigger slice of that pie and put it towards preventative, which are things like community services for taking care of kids, food stamps that prevent the desperation that leads to a large portion of crime, education that prevents people from feeling like they have no other options and no decent job prospects, and that leads them to feeling a desperation that they need to turn to crime.
I definitely personally feel like education is the biggest thing that needs the most reform.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt. Because if you're in a school system where you have limited opportunities and teachers that, you quite frankly, suck.
Yeah.
They don't care about their jobs because they're getting paid nothing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It, like, you're just asking for these kids to, like, I'm not saying it's only those kids, but, like, that's just a large group of people that are not, that are going to be at a disadvantage.
I always bring this book up. It obviously has made an impact on me, but in The Righteous Mind, Jonathan Haidt talks about how conservative people seem to be almost more minded towards smaller communities, and so that's why, they seem to be, they care more about, like, the very close social fabric. You know, that's a classic like buzzword for classic conservatism. The social fabric, they care about that on a smaller individual level, whereas liberal people care more about that on a large level. So that's kind of, you kind of see that in the idea of big government versus small government. Like, the liberal people want there to be more of a, I guess, social fabric or just unity on a larger level, but conservative people want there to be less government so that the bonds and the ties within their smaller groups can be stronger. But anyways, the reason that I'm saying that is I think that that's part of the reason why a lot of conservative people have had such negative backlash to the idea of defunding the police, because potentially of a misunderstanding, but also they know, like you potentially, they know some of their friends like that are police officers, or when they live in these smaller circles, even if it's not a friend that they know outside of it, they just know the cop in their area. And they also, because conservative people are like not as high in openness and resist change, they just don't want that idea around, you know?
Yeah, and I appreciate where that comes from. I think fear is a very real thing that affects us, whether we're aware of it or not. And I know there are racist things in our entire society, and I don't want those to stick around, but it can be difficult for me to hear people talk about all police are racist, fuck the police, etc., etc. I get where it comes from. It comes from the same fear place and recognition of problems that I may be blind to. And I want to listen to that. I want to hear it. But it can be hard sometimes, because when I think of cops, I think of my friends Blinks and Todd and plenty of others that I know will save my life as firefighters and will protect my life as police officers, whether or not that's true of every individual that I've met who are police officers.
It's just hard for me to understand people that go and say stuff like that, like F the police, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And they're like fighting against these generalizations while they themselves are making
wide sweeping generalizations.
I think generalizations are just, it's hard, bordering on impossible to talk on the large scale without them. But when you get to any real level of change, and when I say real level of change, I'm not talking about the decision making in a specific federal law. I'm talking about the implementation of a city ordinance on this group of 20 people who are the top officers at a police department. It becomes impossible to...
Like, what would an example of that be?
So, a federal regulation now says that a certain percentage of any city's budget needs to go towards education.
Mm-hmm.
That's an unusual type of law. I mean, I don't know how many have been passed that say that, but we can all conceive of a federal unfunded mandate that says 20% of your education, but 20% of your city budget has to be education. That's probably way higher than any of them would ever say, but just as an example. So now someone has to sit down and say, we're cutting this much across the board in all of these departments. Now we get to the police department and the fire department, and they have to say, all right, we have this much less money. How are we cutting that? The federal law came from a place of, we need better education and police are reactionary, education is preventative. Absolutely a great generalization. I think it's a positive rule of thumb. But now someone's implementing that law on a very small scale where they're thinking about the individuals in front of them. And on an individual scale, it becomes a lot harder to see implicit bias, even from someone on the outside. So choosing who to fire or who to lay off or where to make the cuts in your equipment becomes so difficult because those generalizations don't work on that scale. They're just not true when you say this group of 20 people are this way, because mm-hmm. individuals are so different from each other.
Yeah.
With the idea of generalizations, in that Joe Rogan episode I listened to with the Stanford neuroscientist, his name was Andrew Huberman, I'm pretty sure, and he talked about how in science they I might be getting the exact terminology wrong here, but in the field of science they have what they call, I think, chunkers and splitters, and I'm positive it's splitters. I don't remember if it's chunkers or not, but the point holds.
I really hope it's chunkers.
Chunkers. So the point holds where he says, you know, you'll have these. He was talking about Dr. Fauci and how this guy hopes, or he wished that there was more of like a panel of experts that people could hear from, as opposed to kind of just one source. And he
there are, but people just choose not to.
Well,
it's hard.
Yeah, but anyways, and so he was talking about how. Chunkers are the people who like just like to chunk information kind of together and then make these sweeping generalizations, and then splitters are people who like really take each fact for just on its own and then kind of analyze that. And so the example he was making is splitters can be really frustrating to work with, because, you know, say, you know, you're working, you know, on designing an experiment, whatever. They're all exhausted. They want to go to lunch, do their lunch break and whatever. And they're like, yeah, this sounds good. But then the splitter is going to be like, hang on, let's slow down a minute. We need to look at this thing right here. This, and this doesn't line up with the rest of the experiment that we're creating. And I think that I don't know this for a fact, but I would guess that philosophers are generally much more of splitters, because in order to have a consistent philosophical view, you have to, you know, be splitting up each individual component. Like if you have a syllogism, P1, P2 conclusion, you have to take each part of the syllogism for its own and make sure it logically flows. And I would also posit that potentially people with higher IQs and higher in open trait openness would also be more likely to be splitters, because I think that if you're just going to, you know, for instance, I think Sam Mattingly is a great example of that. He just likes to take each individual example or individual idea for what it is, and then just take that for what it is and not necessarily see based on what his conclusion might be, where that would fit into his worldview or where that would fit into his other views on a related topic. So for instance, it's okay, I wish that there was more of this, for conservative people to concede some liberal ideas and vice versa. But I think that because a lot of our country are chunkers, they don't like to give up or relinquish that fact sometimes.
Yeah. I think the chunkers versus splitters thing is really interesting. And I would agree with you about philosophy being more tending towards splitters.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a very different reason for thinking that. I think your point is very valid, but the reason that I went to that when you initially mentioned the idea of chunkers versus splitters was I think philosophers are more likely to be splitters because to have the kind of consistent debate that doesn't just become circular of the same statements over and over again, and to be able to think so deeply that you can write an entire thesis about one enormously tiny facet of this one specific philosophical theory.
Or one paper, even. People write theses on, like, exactly. One paper that one philosopher wrote.
To be able to write like that, you have to be able to take each individual part and say, I agree with this premise, I don't agree with this premise, and that changes all of this. You have to be able to move from one little thing at a time so that your disagreement doesn't stagnate on one thing or one broader concept.
Mm-hmm. And that's also why in philosophy, I think, definitions get disagreed upon so often is because people split, you know?
Yeah. I think lawyers as well. If you've ever read, like, word for word, a legal document, like a law, a couple blocks ago, so my school does one class at a time. So when I say block, I mean a class that takes the place over a month.
How long are the blocks? 4 weeks.
About a month. Yeah.
Four. So it takes one class for an entire month. Then
3.5 weeks and 5 days a week.
That's probably really cool.
It's really interesting. A discussion for in a minute. but a couple blocks ago, I was taking a class where I had to, for a presentation, research international maritime law. It was about, like, how international waters are used. And I was able to find a PDF of the actual UN charter on the matter. And it was really interesting because first I had to scroll through a couple different languages to get to English. And when I got to English, there was an entire section before anything else that defined terms that had to be used. So things like where the international waters start off of a coast, how that's adjusted when you have, like, an island off the coast of a country. And these all these really tiny little things that seem like they wouldn't matter that I'm not sure someone with a complete chunker mindset would even come up with. So I think, in my mind, at the very least, the people who write laws, even if they aren't the people that conceive of laws, have to be splitters to think on that level of detail to ensure there aren't massive loopholes because you forgot to define what boat is or what, like, a commercial shipment as opposed to a family fishing boat, how those are different. Mm. I think it'd be so easy to overlook, but you have to be someone with that kind of mindset to even catch that sort of thing.
And you've probably got, like, 10, 12 lawyers looking
right.
at that.
Who all have their own, like, dispositions and preconceptions and different
They're all working towards one argument, and they're like, hey, wait, this definition doesn't lead to this argument.
Right. Like, I'm interested how the idea of chunking versus splitting and the different dispositions that people might have leads to different levels of self-knowledge. Do you think that is an integral part of it, or what do you think is the larger issue? Because I know you love thinking about that stuff.
Yeah, so just as, like, an initial kind of segue into this, I mean, you did a great transition, but to kind of move from a smooth transition to a very chunky one. So I'm dyslexic, and in second grade, I was diagnosed with dyslexia and ADHD. And that led to me going to a school in Atlanta that specializes in teaching dyslexic students. And then 2 years after that, I went to a school that they knew fit my learning style. Because I was in small classes, teachers were able to kind of identify different learning styles and the needs of individual students, and they used that information to find schools you could outplace to for later on that would be a better fit for your learning style. So when I was looking at colleges, I used a lot of what I'd learned about myself through just noticing my habits and how I study and how I get work done and how I'm productive to find a school that would work well for me. So I definitely think you're right that I've kind of gotten in the habit of thinking about how I know certain things about myself and how I can learn certain things about myself. But now to return the chunkers and splitters thing, I think having self-knowledge, everyone has some kind of self-knowledge, and you have to assume there's a fallibility in your own self-knowledge, because I think all of us know we don't know how others see us. And there's going to be something that doesn't match with what we're putting out there as opposed to what we're intending. And I think that's the same paradigm issue of self-knowledge versus the knowledge of others. So when you look at chunkers and splitters in that situation, I think I'm more of a splitter. So the things that I know are very specific. I know the situations where I get work done. I know why those situations help me get work done. And I know how that influences what kind of classes I'm good at, what teaching formats I understand well. Whereas I think a chunker would have a better understanding than I do of the broader patterns in why they enjoy certain subjects. I don't think it affects how your self-knowledge works or how much self-knowledge you have. I think it affects what self-knowledge you know. So I think I focus when I'm trying to understand myself a lot more on how individual people see me and how those interactions, what those interactions tell me, as opposed to I tend to have this kind of disposition, or I tend to have this kind of jargon, or word choice, I should say. And I think that's the difference you notice in chunkers. That is my theory of the difference in chunkers versus splitters on self-knowledge.
Pretty comprehensive, man.
Yeah.
Jeez.
I mean, do you think...
I don't think I'm one or the other, probably. And I don't know what the other is like.
I feel like maybe...
How can you know? Chunker, that's self-knowledge.
Exactly.
Chunker and splitter maybe isn't completely binary as we're making it out to be. There are certain facets of life where maybe people are thinking the chunker way and they think right. the splitter way in other facets of life.
And that's kind of like tribalism in a way, you know? Like, if you... It's not necessarily logical to just be a diehard, you know, fan of a team. I mean, for us, like, the Braves now have pretty much no players on it that they did when we were 8 years old, yet we, like, have, like, loved them all the same. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And so we just chunk the idea of loving the Braves or whatever, but splitting it, maybe no sports fans do, and I'm maybe one of the most guilty of that. Luke, I'm interested about, do you think that it takes something, like a challenge to overcome for someone like you with dyslexia, do you think that it takes something like that to, for someone to get so interested and so honest with themselves in self-knowledge? Or do you think that someone can be as equally honest and objective with themselves in self-knowledge even without something like that?
So I think anytime we learn something, in general, it's because we're challenged by something that relates to it. So in that way, I think the initial situation that you put out there, which is you learn things through big challenges, is true, but I don't think it has to be big challenges. I mean, dyslexia is something that I will always have. I went to a different school for it for 2 years. I completely changed my education path because of it. But even like little social interactions, if you notice that like this friend has stopped hanging out with you and then you confront them and they tell you what it is, that's one person. You might forget who that person is, but what you learn from that interaction could be so fundamental to how you change the way you hope to be perceived.
And let me interrupt you. That's also why I feel like there's such pressure sometimes for people at camp, because you never know like what one thing might influence someone. But anyways,
Definitely. Continue.
I
think it takes conflict and challenge to learn anything about yourself, because you see yourself in a situation that you aren't normally in, or else you wouldn't have the contrast to what I thought before as to what I think now, to see that you've even learned anything. If you can learn something without any kind of challenge or change, I think any class challenges your preconceptions, and that's how you learn.
So then what about people that don't have challenges? Like, do they have to self-impose challenges? How are they supposed to learn
about themselves?
I mean, I think everyone has some level of challenge. I think challenge and pain and difficulty is a relative term. I mean, I have dyslexia, but I'm not, like, unable... I don't have a social, like, disorder right. where I have difficulty relating to other people, and that's a different kind of challenge that I think is more inherently... I think it affects more of how we live in our current society, in our form of society, than my dyslexia does, and in that way, it's a bigger challenge, but also to some extent, any struggles and challenges are relative. So when you say someone who has no challenges, I'm not sure that exists. But I think if you somehow were able to take an absolute measure, there are some people with really tiny challenges, and maybe they don't learn as much about themselves, but it's going to feel in their perception as just as big a challenge as I had when I discovered I was dyslexic, or I've had when I was learning to read.
Maybe they have challenges, however they run away from them. So instead of trying to take them on and learning about themselves or learning about something, they just...
I think it also begs the question of if someone were in a vacuum and they, you know, and say you just had your consciousness, you know, and you had whatever, like, natural dispositions, but you didn't have, like, challenges necessarily, and you also didn't have anyone to compare yourself to or to hear feedback from, would self-knowledge be possible in that sense, or would it just be an almost id that thinks, as opposed to an ego or a superego?
I don't know. I think, and obviously this is exclusively theory because it frankly can't exist unless you're going to lock a kid in a white box from their birth and just leave them there.
Right.
That you would have knowledge, but because everything is self-knowledge at that point, because you have no knowledge of anything else, then there would be no self-knowledge. Like, I think self-knowledge exists.
It's relative because, to other knowledges.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I know a lot about Blake, but by knowing something about Blake, it allows me to separate what I know about Blake from what I know about myself. But if I've never known anyone else, if I never knew Blake, I wouldn't know the things I know about myself because I can contrast myself with Blake.
Mm-hmm. So you'd just be
I think it would just be one kind of knowledge. Yeah.
So do you think...
That's my theory.
So do you think that... to what degree do you think self-knowledge builds off of comparing yourself to others and getting feedback from them? And also, like, what kind of people are better suited to take that kind of information well as opposed to just kind of fight it off like you were mentioning,
John? You should read Hegel.
Yeah,
Hegel.
Well...
this is Hegel.
Really?
Okay.
Hegel, so Descartes is like, I think, therefore I am. And Hegel's like, sure. No, you see other people, therefore you are.
Yeah. I mean, I think both of these things are interesting. So first, Descartes, I think that's really interesting because Hegel's response to Descartes' theory of the perfect deceiver.
Evil demon,
exactly. Evil demon. would be, does it matter?
Yeah.
Is the illusion good enough that it almost, like, you would want to know that, but does it matter? You're still developing. You're still growing, even if all of your perceptions are deceiving. Even if everything you know is untrue.
Right.
Then you're still developing through the conflict, even if the conflict is all fake.
Right.
Based on your... I don't know Hegel very well, but based on the short description you gave me, that would be my guess is his response.
Yeah, I need to read some Hegel, because... Yeah. I've read Descartes, but I haven't read him.
And then, Blake, what was...
I was asking about, you know... To what degree is feedback from other people / comparing yourself to other people important for self-knowledge, and what kind of people are better suited for that as opposed to kind of shying away from the issues that they
have
been addressed?
I think in terms of being able to compare yourself to other people or consider how you interact with other people, I think it's pretty much essential to self-knowledge. But I think the idea of getting feedback from other people is unnecessary to self-knowledge, but important if not necessary to self-understanding. Because to me, self-knowledge is one side of who you are. And to truly understand yourself, you have to know both sides. And getting a feedback of, what do you think of me? What did you take away from your interaction with me? How do I present myself? Leads to better understanding of yourself. And the feedback you give yourself from an interaction with another, that leads to self-knowledge, because that's you doing it all inside of your own head of how did I change from interacting with that person? What do they have that I don't? What do I have that they don't? That's happening so internally that I would consider that necessary to growing self-knowledge. And for some, I don't know if there's a different term than understanding, but to me, that's the next level up from knowledge is understanding. And to me, that would mean understanding is understanding both sides.
I definitely think
it's important to take a grain of salt when you're relying on other people for your self-perception, because what's to say that that person is right, you know? Like,
yeah. Or honest with you.
There's some people that are, yeah, right? We're honest. There's... there's always going to be a bit of personal bias. Like, maybe you
or an agenda.
Someone feel some way, and they're like, hey, you made me feel this way, so I'm going to make you feel bad about that. Mm-hmm. But in reality, it's like, maybe you just said the truth, and that hurt that person, you know?
Right. And so what they're saying has no merit.
They're pretty much invalidated in that sense.
You're becoming Descartes.
On that note, I think we're getting close to the time limit. But Luke, thanks so much for coming on. That was a great conversation.
I love being here.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. Well, anyone have any last words?
I'm good.
Nope.
All right. Back to school soon. Goodbye, everybody.